Good morning, everyone. Today is May 12th, 2009, 8 o'clock in the morning, and this is the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs. Delighted to see everybody here, and we're going to change the schedule just a little bit to get all of our representatives and senators to testify in the bills. So I'll be opening up bills and then closing them, and then we're going to do our informational hearing, and then we'll start in with the bills. So which bill?
2045.
Okay, Okay, Diane is
2022.
Okay, first I'm going to open a public hearing on 3022, and who's going to?
I'm actually doing it today.
Okay. All right. Oh God. Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Are we ready?
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and for the record, I'm State Senator Diane Rosenbaum from Senate District 21, also appearing today as co-chair of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance. And as you probably know already, this is Women's Health Week. It's the 10th anniversary of Women's Health Week, so it's especially appropriate to be bringing you the bill that you're about to hear about. So I want to thank you for your consideration of House Bill 3022, which comes to you as part of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance 2009 legislative agenda and will permit healthcare practitioners to access prescription medication to treat certain sexually transmitted diseases or certainly sexually transmitted infections. We call this expedited partner therapy, which is the clinical practice of treating sex partners of patients diagnosed with an STI without clinical examination. As co-chair of Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, I urge your support of this bill. By modifying Oregon law, the boards of pharmacy, medical examiner, nursing, and naturopathy would be allowed to address any statutory obstacles to EPT that fall under their respective purviews. To prevent reinfection, complication, and further spread of STIs, both partners must receive timely and appropriate STI treatment. In many cases, the partners of infected patients do not seek treatment. This bill will remove barriers to providing prescriptions for the partners of patients who have two of the most common and easy to treat STIs, gonorrhea and chlamydia. Expedited partner therapy is currently permitted in at least 11 other states, including our neighbors to the north and south, Washington and California. You will be hearing shortly from technical experts, and so if you have technical questions, probably those would be best addressed to those folks. But I am also happy to answer any questions, and thank you very much for your consideration of this bill and hope that you will be able to move it to the floor. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. I do think this is excellent policy. That's part of what my job was as a public health nurse. And so many times we couldn't get the partner in, but we could give the medicine to the person who was diagnosed, and then she took it to the partner. All right. With that, I will close.
Just a quick comment. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, this just sort of places in law what commonly happens right now. And nobody really wants to admit that. Sort of a wink-wink goes on many, many times with patients. And you know the partner's not coming. You know you're not going to get them in. And you write a prescription that's larger than is actually necessary, knowing what's going to happen. And I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. It's something that many of us, not that I would ever do this, have felt uncomfortable doing. And so I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on 3022 and open a public hearing on 2435. And that is Representative Roblin.
Yeah.
Oh, we've got a duo.
A duo. This is third.
2435.
Thank you,
Chair Anderson and the Senate Committee on Health and Veterans Affairs. My name is Arnie Roblin, and I am the representative from District 9. Last interim, I was in the committee chair for a group on rural policy, a committee on rural policy, and we took a Southern Oregon health tour with our committee to look at what were the issues that most presented themselves as difficulties in providing health services to rural communities. And one of the more consistent issues was the ability to license and get doctors working in rural areas. And so we heard story after story, and the one that was closest to home was a group in Reedsport who indicated that they had lost about half their physicians because of retirement, and it just took them an enormous amount of time. And some doctors, actually one doctor came and talked that it had taken, by the time all the papers got completed, over a year for him to get all of the licensing things. And this little person, in this particular case, would not have been affected by this law because they were coming from outside of the country. But a number of stories about how difficult and how long it took for the person to get their certification and start practicing, even though they had moved and they were in a community sometimes. They couldn't get the license, and they didn't understand why it was taking so long. They recognized that part of the process is the requirement that the board has that every piece of document has to be in before they start reviewing. And if a clinic that they had worked at before chose not to send it and it was part of the requirement, then they waited until that came. And so getting the people to respond oftentimes was very difficult. In Roseburg, they're looking forward to 54 doctors retiring in the next 5 years. And so there is this consistent issue that's out there that rural doctors in general are a little older, and they are going to have to retire. Many of them don't retire. And it's not because they didn't choose to. I mean, they've chosen not to, but there's nobody to replace them. They can't find that person to take over and be there. And so they just hang on, and it's very frustrating both to them and to their communities. And you're going to hear some more from another community. So what we did, or what I did, is after that was all taken care of, we drafted a bill. We didn't have our final rural committee meeting to put all the committee bills in, and so a couple of them didn't happen. And this one, I introduced myself, and it basically says that we're going to have a temporary license procedure, which allows the board to give a temporary license after 14 days. They can do the criminal background check. They can do the other kinds of things that we have control over. And if there aren't any red flags, then they give them a temporary license. That temporary license can be renewed while they're getting all the other paperwork. And I guess the part, my whole life, I have had really good friends. My best friend when I was growing up, his dad was a doctor. My best friend in Coos Bay was a doctor who passed away recently. And one of the reasons that I get along sometimes is my personality generally gets along with people who are sometimes cranky. I have some very, very... They often had difficult times getting along with other people. Great patients, relationships, great other kinds of stuff, but their relationships with other adults sometimes was not always the most positive. And so I looked at that, and that's one of the doctors talked to me about why this was a problem, and that is he said he may be working at a clinic in some place. Example would be, let's say, Idaho. And the clinic administrator, who is not a doctor, who really has no understanding about how important doctor was, including this particular person, might have a difficult relationship, and he might decide that I'm not going to work in this clinic any longer. I'm going to go someplace else. And so he chooses to go someplace else and maybe decides to go just across the border into Oregon. And that relationship was bad enough, in fact. It had nothing to do with medical, but it was bad enough that when the request came to fill in all the information about the person's previous work history, the administrator gets the document and says, well, I'll get to this a little later, and puts it aside. Now, there's no requirement that the board has, nor the doctor has, to force that person to send a letter explaining that their criteria. And so eventually the doctor decides, I guess I'm not going to get my license in Oregon. I might as well go back and find a place in Idaho where I already have my license, and they go and we lose that person. That has nothing to do with their ability to perform medical duties. In fact, they might be an exceptional doctor. It has everything to do with relationships. And the way our system is set up right now, relationships may play a more important aspect with respect to getting a license than the medical competence of that person. We heard testimony that there is like 1 out of 1,000, 0.5% of the doctors that we bring in here after going through the process have a problem. And My contention is if they know that eventually this is all going to find out and there's a problem back there, they aren't going to move across the country, work for a couple, for 6 months, and then find out they're going to be gone because there's something wrong in their license or something fraudulent that they didn't report. So I have a difficult time believing this will cause anything to do, any problems with respect to safety, and I do believe that it will expedite figuring out a solution. You will be hearing, I think, about an amendment that will expedite the system, and I think that's a really great thing to do, and I believe
it's
that...
It's the A6, as I assume.
And I believe that the board has all the authority in the world to go ahead and do that right now, and I wish that they would, because I think that would help the whole state. But in the meantime, I really think that the way the bill is written, we can force that expedited matter to even happen faster. So I'd appreciate you considering the bill, and I look forward to answering any questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, thank you for hearing this bill. Hugely important to my community. I'm Cliff Benz, representative from District 60, which, of course, is Malheur County, Harney County, Baker County, and part of Grant County. 26,000 square miles. I've never counted the doctors, but we don't have enough. I was the lawyer for Holy Rosary Medical Center for 18 years before it was purchased by CHI. And during that 18 years, I had many opportunities to assist the credentialing secretary, who is now Robin Burns, in trying to facilitate the paperwork on different physicians and other specialists that wanted to come to Ontario. I had numerous occasions to contact the Board of Medical Examiners and work with them. I have handed out a piece of paper today that was put together by Robin Burns that shows the experience of the hospital over the course of 1 year. It's not my job today to try to blame anybody for the situation. I think, in fact, it's really most of the time a situation similar to what Representative Roblin just described, that is waiting for paperwork to come in from distant places while the physician waits also. The question is, what is the proper device? And I, as a lawyer, a licensed professional, understand the difficulty in creating a separate licensing procedure and the problems that go with that. I would rather have just one licensing procedure. That would be a lot less complicated. The question is, what is the tool that we use to try to allow these people to begin to practice and provide medical care while we wait for the paperwork to come in? What is the proper tool? A year and 4 months ago, when I first was appointed to this position, one of the first things I did was to contact the board when I got here and suggest that we needed to do something. And I was assured that rural hospitals were put on the top of the pile and indeed would receive rapid review. That may have been the case, but the problem seems to still persist. And so when this bill, I actually had introduced a bill almost identical to this one, so I forgot about it and joined Representative Roblin and Representative Greenland in attempting to support some sort of a resolution to this difficulty. The problem that we have in Ontario and other small towns is that we have a limited time to get people to come to our communities. And we don't want anything to delay. Once a decision is made, we really want them there. Doctors are a valuable and rare commodity out in my part of the world. And we want to give them any excuse for not being there. And waiting 2 or 3 months to be credentialed is an excuse. We need doctors. One of the problems we have in Ontario is that folks can easily get licensed in Idaho. And there's quite a push to establish larger facilities on the Idaho side of the river. This is going to be hugely damaging to Oregon. Licensing is not the only issue in Oregon. There are other much more difficult issues, which I hope to be able to assist in resolving. But this is a small problem. I think the limited license device is one that could work, and I very much appreciate your committee making the effort to try to help us. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments?
Oh, I have to make a few comments.
All right.
First off, I'd like to comment about the phrase cranky and hanging on, okay? Some of us are not hanging on. We actually enjoy what we do. But I understand in rural practices that's not always the case, that they do stay longer than they should and longer than they want to because they have a commitment to their community. as their patients and don't want to abandon them and without someone else coming in. And it's, this issue is especially difficult for rural communities. I understand that. It also is a problem across the state. It's not one just for rural communities. Some of the larger organizations have difficulty recruiting physicians, have difficulty getting them through their licensing. They have to get them certified through insurance companies. We have a medical malpractice issue in this state that is keeping people out of the red states where physicians from other states do not want to come here. I think that's probably what Representative Benz was talking about. You locate your clinic across the river in another state and avoid some malpractice issues, something that many people in this building do not want to address or talk about. But it's a real issue for Oregon, whether we like to admit it or not, and it's going to get us in the end if we don't start dealing with it, because we're going to run out of physicians, and we're going to run out of them rapidly as they age out. By the time someone goes through credentialing for insurance companies and the hospital and getting all the paperwork together to the board, it can take up to a year and longer sometimes. The board's issue is they need the paperwork done. And once they get that paperwork in their hands, they do a pretty good job of getting it through. But waiting for that paperwork can be difficult for the reasons you've talked about. And many times you're asking another physician to give a reference on the physician. And I tell you, when you're working 90 hours a week, that kind of gets pushed to the side. And you don't get around to writing a letter of recommendation for somebody. And usually it's in handwriting, nobody can read anyway. But it's difficult. So we need a better process. And Madam Chair, I think we're going to be looking at what I believe to be a better process later on today when we have an opportunity to bring the Dash 6 forward. So I appreciate you bringing this up. I think it's a good start. We may be jumping past this a bit with a bill that might actually help you even more than this does. So thank you.
Excellent.
And I just want to respond. I hope that that is absolutely true and that it works. I get concerned, and so I will wait and watch, and we'll watch this one closely. But it is something that I wish, and not just for this board, but other boards would look at their procedures from time to time and take suggestions earlier as opposed to having it come in front of this body. We did offer, actually, in a work group to make our bill available to all physicians in the state. That was not necessarily looked upon as the appropriate deal, and so we didn't do that one. But I do agree with you that it is a statewide issue. Depending on what the board does, we will watch closely to see if, in fact, it has an effect on future ability to get our people there. We have an advantage that Representative Benz may have the same advantage, but in our coastal area, there are a lot of people who wish to come, and we have a number of doctors that are looking at coming there that probably in their 50s and they haven't decided they want to quit, but they love the Oregon coast, and that has given us an opportunity at times to get people, but the waiting has made it really difficult for them, and they come and move out, and then it takes a year, and they decide, I really like this retirement. I really don't need my license because I'm going to do just fine. And we would rather that they got into the habit of being the doctor for a while, for that 10 or 15 years that they might be productive. So all of these things are helpful.
We need to move on. We have a full agenda. Thank you, gentlemen.
Chair, just one comment, and I take a look at the six as an area of concern is the 50,000. It seems potentially artificially low. For malpractice, so.
And we will look at that. We won't be moving it today. We're gathering all the information and then see how comfortable everybody is. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on 2435, and I'll open a public hearing on HJM 20. Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. I'm Michael Denbrough, Representative for House District 45. That's Northeast Portland to Park Rose. And I'm pleased to bring House Joint Memorial 20 to you today. This memorial is one piece of a puzzle that we're all working on to try to create a healthcare system that will work for all Oregonians and all Americans. The House Healthcare Committee, and I'm sure your committee as well, I know your committee as well, has talked about the problem of inadequate reimbursement rates for Medicaid and Medicare providers. We've seen this problem most dramatically in the frontline areas of primary care, which we know is the linchpin of a system that brings us health and wellness. As we in Oregon strive to make healthcare more accessible and affordable, and focused on primary care, we know that we're going to need the federal government to begin to do things differently as well. House Joint Memorial 20 addresses two problems with the way that the federal government funds Medicare. First of all, the reimbursement rates paid to providers are generally inadequate. And second, and most relevant to us here in Oregon, they're inconsistent among the states. States where health care is more expensive to deliver receive higher reimbursement rates. And those states, like Oregon, which have found ways to deliver care less expensively, are rewarded, or I should say penalized, by lower reimbursement rates. And senators, I think you'll join me in assessing this, if we can use the highly technical term. This is nuts, really. Oregon should be being rewarded for being a model in using systems like Medicare Advantage to a greater extent than other states, not penalized, not being its victim as we are. Our committee, as we were discussing this issue in general, we heard testimony demonstrating many of the negative effects of this inadequacy. Physicians are limiting, we found that physicians are limiting their clients who are at or approaching Medicare age. They're shutting their practice from accepting new Medicare patients. Not only that, many physicians are actually turning away their existing patients once they reach or are approaching Medicare age. And this is extremely disruptive for patients who've been with these doctors for some time, particularly disruptive for those, let me step back, and of course Medicare is not just a program for seniors, it's also a program for people with disabilities who in many cases have even more challenges in finding new providers. This is, you know, it's a very difficult situation. In many cases, the patients feel that they're being abandoned, and it's something I know that doctors don't feel good about, and we had physicians from the OMA come in and testify to this issue. In fact, the OMA has passed a resolution urging its, you know, the colleague members not to turn away patients. But, you know, given these reimbursement rates, it's hard for many doctors to keep their practices going and without managing their client base. It's a terrible situation, shameful and intolerable. And as our population ages, we're only going to see more demands for primary care physicians who will treat Medicare patients. It's vital that we take action now, both in investing in new primary care providers and in reimbursing them properly so that we can retain them. The federal government, of course, controls Medicare reimbursement rates. And as we in Oregon do the best we can to cut health care costs, provide health insurance to more people, and improve the quality of care they receive, we must ask the federal government for help in repairing this dysfunctional system. So therefore, my colleague, Representative Brent Barton, and I had this memorial drafted, which calls on the President and Congress to address this problem and gives our congressional delegation a necessary tool to advocate on our behalf. Senators, I hope that you will join the House in endorsing this concept and supporting this memorial. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And I should also mention, during the course of our our hearing, we got a report from UPER called Medicare Acceptance by Oregon Physicians, a snapshot of trends from the 2006 Oregon Physician Workforce Survey that you might find interesting, and I'll have it passed on to you.
Thank you, Representative Dembro. This is an issue that all of us are very familiar with. Is there any discussion?
No, I think he's presented the case well.
Okay. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 20 and open a work session on HJM 20.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 20 to the floor with a due adopt recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 20 to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Discussion?
Just one thing. This isn't the first time we've done this.
Nope.
No, this isn't. Any opposition? So ordered. Who would like to carry this bill?
I'll carry the bill.
Yes, Senator Bates will carry this bill. All right, with that, we're going to have to change. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2718. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for letting me visit you this morning from next door in the Revenue Committee. It's interesting to hear your bills. You have a lot of good work to do here, and I've appreciated all of it. I'll be very brief because you've heard this bill before. House Bill 2718A is the twin to, and I've now forgotten the Senate bill number, but Senator Johnson and I introduced identical bills on the House side and the Senate side to create a task force to study the needs of women's veterans in order to improve our service to them when they come home from serving our country. The only difference between these two bills at this point is that in the House Veterans Affairs and Emergency Management Committee under the leadership of Chair Cowan, there were two amendments to the bill which added some perspectives, and I think that they were very important amendments. The first, Representative Riley had suggested that the task force should actually include a woman veteran who had experienced duty, and that made sense to us. And then the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force had contacted me and the committee because the bill called for a study of women when they experience sexual assault trauma, and they had recommended that we have a sexual assault advocate, someone with experience supporting individuals who have been survivors of sexual assault, on the task force. And so with those two changes, the bill is otherwise identical to the bill that you've already passed out of this committee. The other interesting thing that happened with this bill in the House is the first fiscal impact statement we got back was a minimal, and so the Speaker rescinded the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. When we amended the bill, we got a fiscal that had a dollar figure in it, so the committee sent it on to Ways and Means. We then got a letter back from Ways and Means saying they didn't necessarily wish to see this bill there, and so it was reconsidered by the committee and sent to the floor, and what was sent to us from legislative fiscal was a letter about fiscal impacts for task forces and their indication that at that time they didn't need to see it. I don't know what your decision will be here today, and I leave it up to your good judgment how best to move forward with this issue. I think it's very important that we do establish a task force to study the needs of these women who have served us so well, whether that is in this vehicle or the Senate vehicle, and whether you send this today to the floor or Ways and Means. What's important to me is that the issue moves forward, and I'm deeply grateful. This bill really is a bill of the task force on veteran services, and with much appreciation to Senator Johnson in particular for her work in getting this off the ground.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gelser, let me see if I can sort this out. The House committee made amendments to the same bill that make it a better bill, and it's on its way to the House, the Senate bill, so it's on its way to the House floor now?
No. This is the bill that was made better.
Yes.
This is the amended version.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And this is past the House floor.
So if we do this one, then the Senate bill goes away.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Okay. And colleagues, since we already heard it and it's been well vetted, I would just as soon move on because I didn't realize you were going to spend so much time and we have a full agenda. So with that, if you don't mind, I would like to close the public hearing on 2178A and open a work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2718.
No, 21.
Huh?
2718.
2718. Are you with us?
Yeah, I just have a summary sheet that has a different bill number.
Okay.
So
okay.
It is this one. Yes, my summary, just to clarify, it's 2718.
It's a typo.
Our typo on our summary sheet says it's 2178.
Okay.
Would you please,
I just looked
how it got into the right bill, I have no idea.
Yeah, the staff, obviously.
Obviously.
Okay. Anyway, right.
Yes.
If I could continue, I move House Bill 2718 and gross the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2718 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and Senator Johnson will carry this bill. And I'll close the work session on 2718, and I apologize for those people who signed up, but I think we've heard from you before. And with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on 2176. Mr. Shook.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2176 modifies the qualifications required for appointment to advisory committee that advises the Director of Veterans Affairs.
Okay, and who's okay, Mr. Willis, please come forward. Well, I need to change.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2176, which is an agency housekeeping bill drafted to make minor adjustments to the eligibility requirements for those seeking an appointment to the Governor's Veterans Advisory Committee. The Advisory Committee works with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs in an advisory capacity and consists of 9 members chosen from throughout the state. Under the current statute, the Governor appoints all 9 members who are war veterans as defined by statute. The Governor's appointments shall represent each war era, with at least 1 member being from the Korean conflict, and at least 3 members shall be in periods following the Korean conflict. In reviewing this statute, the Department believes that mandating that certain era veterans be appointed is not practical in all situations. As the World War II and Korean War veteran populations age, and more veterans are created due to Iraq and Afghanistan, the makeup of the advisory committee may need more flexibility to serve the needs of all Oregon veterans. In addition, the department is also seeking to have the word war removed before veteran. The department does not believe that veterans should be subcategorized by their service. Everyone who honorably served is a veteran. By eliminating the word war from veteran, more veterans would be eligible to serve on this committee. The department values all veterans from every era. We are committed to having representation from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, and current conflicts on the committee, providing advice and counsel regarding our mission and its application. However, the department believes that by making minor modifications to the eligibility requirements, the governor will have more flexibility in creating an advisory committee that can address the issues facing the department today and into the future. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
This makes perfect sense, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Let's just do it.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2176, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2176.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2176 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2176 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Well, it just seems strange. We're doing something that makes perfect sense so quickly.
No.
I'll vote for it.
Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Senator Moore.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Morissette.
Aye. Motion carries. And would you like to carry this bill?
I certainly would.
All right. Senator Bates is going to carry this just because he's a veteran and he needs to carry one veteran's bill this session. With that, I will close the... I will close the...
I'm not sure that made perfect sense.
...work session on House Bill 2176. Okay, now I'm going to open a public hearing on how... I'm changing the order. We were going to have the informational session, but because it took so long to get through the preliminary, I'm going to be losing a couple of members at 9:30, so I want to get through some of these other bills. So the informational session will come, but later. With that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3022.
Madam Chair, House Bill 3022A permits certain health professional regulatory boards to adopt rules that permit practitioners to prescribe or dispense antibiotic drugs to partners of patients without examining partner for treatment of sexually transmitted diseases.
Hey, Catherine Bradley and Charlene McGee, would you please come forward?
Thank you.
And whoever wants to go first can go.
Chairman Anderson and committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health. And with me today I have Dr. Schaefer, who's the medical epidemiologist for the state sexually transmitted disease program and is also available to speak to some of the specifics and questions you might have about expedited partner therapy. You have a packet in front of you, and also within that packet is some written testimony. Dr. Beth Epstein, who is the health officer for Hood, River, Wasco, and Sherman County Health Departments, has written a letter in support. Dr. Jim Shames, who is the health officer for Jackson and Josephine County, has written a letter in support. And Judy Cleave, as the president of the Oregon Public Health Association, has also written a letter in support. We are here today to request your support for House Bill 3022A that will improve the ability of healthcare providers in Oregon to treat and prevent cases of sexually transmitted diseases that affect the health of thousands of Oregonians each year. As you heard earlier, this is one of the evidence-based practices that we have identified in the public health sector that allow medical providers to prescribe and dispense antibiotic therapy for sex partner individuals that are infected with STDs. And then when they are unable to perform a face-to-face exam with the patient's partner. This is the essence of expedited partner therapy. This is an example of a conversation that we had with our boards about how could we do the best job of decreasing obstacles that would allow Oregon's boards of medicine, pharmacy, nursing, and naturopathy to actually support expedited partner therapy by making statute changes within their own rules. So by our making this adjustment, the boards are able to follow suit and are very supportive in terms of doing that, and we'll be able to support their providers in using an expedited partner therapy approach. This certainly is a very significant disease issue for Oregon. We have had in 2006 over 9,500 cases reported, although we are well aware that with reinfections, not all cases are reported, and it is estimated that somewhere in the neighborhood of 28,000 Oregonians are affected annually. This particularly is effective in terms of dealing with the issue of reinfection, which is our primary concern, particularly with our young women. It's estimated that we have approximately 20% of women are reinfected within a six-month period of time because their partners are not able to get the antibiotics, and this is seen as gives us the opportunity to be able to do that. Oregon is following about 15 other states that have already put this into practice. We think this.
How many did you say?
15 other states. This is supported by the American Medical Association and the Centers for Disease Control, and in some, we believe this is medically effective, cost-effective, and cost savings, and ask for your support. The Office of Family Health and Dr. Schaefer are available here for your questions. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Charlene Addy McGee, a health educator with the Multnomah County Health Department's African American Sexual Health Equity Program. I'm here to request your support for House Bill 3022A. The goal of the Multnomah County Health Department African American Sexual Health Equity Program is to empower and engage Multnomah County's African American youth and young adults between the ages of 14 to 24 and community members to address the factors that contribute to sexual health disparities. The Multnomah County Health Department's report card on racial and ethnic health disparities highlights inequities adversely affecting Multnomah County's minority communities. The African American community experiences greater health disparities than other racial and ethnic communities. In 2007, the rate of new cases of gonorrhea infections among African American residents of Multnomah County was 6.5 times the rate of white non-Hispanic in the county. Similarly, the rates of new chlamydia cases diagnosed was 5 times higher among African American residents. The physical and economic burden of STDs is well documented. Public health officials suspect that many STDs go undetected. Untreated infections can lead to complications such as pelvic inflammatory disease, tuberous pregnancy, infertility, and further spread of disease. Clinicians need additional strategies to reduce STD inequities in Multnomah County. One such strategy being recommended by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention is expedited partner therapy. Access to treatment and care is a critical strategy for controlling these diseases, especially among adolescent, young adults, and certain racial ethnic groups where rates remain disproportionately high. Monoman County African American Sexual Health Equity Program and HIV STD Prevention and Community Program is pleased to offer our support. Our team consists of five disease intervention specialties. The DIS are CDC-trained public health workers that contact infected clients with chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and HIV to ensure adequate treatment was provided and offer partner notification and treatment. My colleague and I see the impact of STDs on the community daily. Reinfection and lack of treatment for partners are a daily occurrence for the clients we serve. Due to limited funding, DIS are unable to follow up all clients infected with chlamydia or gonorrhea. Currently, DIS follow up with African-American clients younger than age 25, clients tested through the Monoma County Health Department STD clinic, and by medical provider request. However, the rates of chlamydia infections have continued to rise in the last 5 years. Only 33% of new chlamydia cases in Monoma County will offer partner services. That means of the 3,272 cases, only 1,077 will offer services for partners. Thousands of infected patients and their partners will benefit from providers being able to provide EPT. EPT will allow providers to treat patients who normally would not come to the clinic for treatment. Many patients are working minimum wage hours and missing a day of work to come to see a provider is impossible. Other patients simply cannot afford the cost of a visit. EPT will make sure these clients are treated and help stop the spread of infection. In Oregon, as in the United States, emerging data indicates that many providers selectively employ EPT for gonorrhea and chlamydia infection and that some do so routinely. EPT is a useful alternative when the partner is unlikely to seek care or cannot readily receive a timely evaluation or diagnosis. The African American Sexual Health Equity Program of Monoma County Health Department supports EPT as an important public health strategy for our struggle to reduce sexual health disparities in Monoma County. In good faith, we thank you for your support and we look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? This is something I'm very familiar with and very much in favor of it. And no discussion?
There are two issues that are not covered in this bill, and I want to bring them up and get them on the record. And they're both potential barriers, especially in private practice. One is an issue of medical malpractice. Some physicians are reluctant to prescribe for a patient they haven't seen because they're concerned about a drug reaction or drug interaction with another drug of a patient they have not seen, and they're worried about medical malpractice. And that is a barrier to get past. I don't see this bill addressing that barrier, but I want to bring it up again as something that prevents physicians from doing the job they should be doing. Now, the chances for a reaction to the medications to become useful are very low, but they can occur. You can get a drug reaction, you can get an anaphylactic reaction to some of these drugs. It'd be very rare. They could occur, and the physician would be in a position, having not seen the patient, they could be in real trouble. And the partner may not know that information also. So that's one issue. The second issue is one of insurance. When you write a prescription for somebody and you know that prescription is going to be used by somebody else, you, to a degree, are committing a certain amount of fraud. And I doubt that any insurance company would ever come back and argue this, but there have been issues similar to this in the past where when you write a prescription, I've had the unfortunate experience having to deal with an insurance company over how the prescription was written because of the cost. These are both issues that need to be addressed. Probably not in this bill at this time, but something we should look at later time. I think the insurance issue we could have dealt with in this bill with a simple amendment. Mm-hmm. And if we had time, I would do that. I don't know if that's been a discussion on the House side. I don't know if it was a discussion in a work group. And I don't know how other states have dealt with these issues, but I'd like to hear if the panel has anything they can offer as far as information about those two issues.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for the question. Those are both important issues.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Dr. Schaefer. I'm with the State Health Division with the STD, HIV, and Tuberculosis Program. And Dr. Bates is completely correct. That's a concern that's been raised in other states. I think I'm talking about the malpractice issue. And I think that Catherine pointed out that at least 15 other states, the last time we checked, have implemented laws, legislation legislation to legalize this practice, and we're not aware of any malpractice suits that have been brought against physicians or other licensed practitioners for this practice. And at this point, being endorsed by the Centers for Disease Control, American Medical Association, and as you pointed out earlier, Senator Bates, it's actually common practice, and that's been demonstrated by studies and surveys of physicians that over 50% of physicians have engaged in this practice quasi-illicitly, and what we're trying to do here is legitimize a practice that we all know to be good medical practice. The other aspect of this is that at a certain point, it becomes a consideration that one might not be practicing up to the standard of care if they don't attempt to treat the partners, and we're getting to the point where we might be reaching that critical mass of states and practitioners who agree that this is appropriate medical practice. I also wanted to address the issue of insurance, and certainly that's not an aspect, a primary aspect of this particular legislation, but perhaps some information that you might not be as familiar with about the bill is that it directs well, I'm not the legislator or the civics expert, but my understanding is that what it does is it allows pharmacists in this particular circumstance where DHS identifies the diseases that can be treated through this mechanism of expedited partner therapy, it allows pharmacists to fill prescriptions for patients under the patient under the partner's name. So a physician can write a prescription for a named partner, or in fact an unnamed partner, which isn't available to physicians and pharmacists for other kinds of prescriptions. So that would, I think, at least limit some of the concerns you've raised about writing it illicitly in the patient's name.
I saw that, Madam Chair. I saw that as part of the bill, and I appreciate it, but doesn't go to the key question of insurance. But that's probably not going to be an issue, but we could have fixed that in this bill, too. We'll look at it later.
That does bring up a very good point regarding who then pays for the second prescription. First of all, if they don't have insurance, the person who came in and was diagnosed and treated, they pay for their partner's prescription.
Thanks for the question, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. That similarly isn't something that we've attempted to address in this bill. There are many ways that patients' medications are paid for. If they're treated in public settings, they're often treated with medications that are provided on their behalf by the state sexually transmitted disease program. In private settings, those costs are borne by the insurers or by the patients themselves. And
that's what I want to know.
What we're attempting to do in this bill is to legitimize a practice that we know goes on. We haven't attempted to address reimbursement. I think that would be a significant additional task.
Well, it would be, and I was just curious right now, who can the person who was diagnosed insurance pay for that?
That's the issue I'm trying to get to, Madam Chair. Sometimes you write two prescriptions, the second individual will not, and it's usually a guy, will not get the prescription filled because he can't afford it, or says he can't afford it. If you're right, prescription is large enough for both of them, then you're kind of on sort of shaky grounds here. These costs of these drugs, for the most part, are very inexpensive, and it's not a major issue, but it's just part of what we'd like to see in this bill to make it better. We want to take the barriers away here. We're not trying to kill the bill. We're trying to take the barriers away. I'm willing to pass this bill out today as read, but I'd like to, in the future, come back as... I just wish there's been work a little more carefully and come back with some language that protects physicians so that they will go ahead and do this, because I think there's still barriers out there. In a public health setting, it's different. They're under a different situation as far as medical malpractice is concerned. They're in a different situation as far as getting the prescription filled. But the majority of what goes on out there is still in private practice, and there are still barriers even after passing this. And I think not addressing those barriers, or at least make people aware of them, is appropriate. To pass this bill thinking you resolve the issue, when I know of at least two barriers in place yet, is not appropriate. So just making that for the record, I might come back and do some more work on this probably in January or February. Maybe we'll knock the rest of the stuff out then.
Okay.
I do not want to stop the bill now.
You don't? Because I was saying if we could get an amendment before I have five more sessions.
Madam Chair?
It's your choice.
I don't want to hold the bill up, but if you give me a couple of days, I'll work on those amendments.
Now, yeah, I would like to see that.
One of the amendments I'm not going to offer is the one concerning medical malpractice.
No.
That will light up a firestorm. But the one as far as costly prescriptions, I think we might be able to deal with.
And I think it'll be important to talk with Senator Rosenbaum, since this is her bill,
yes.
and see if you would have that discussion with her, and then we'll see if we can even make it a better bill. But it will be passing one way or another. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. Going along the same line, Madam Chair, I mean, we're almost assuming in this discussion that we're dealing with one additional person, and it could be several. So, well, I mean, that's the reality, and that would bring the insurance issue into an even bigger question at that point in time. So, I mean, looking at the definition of partner, it's relatively broad, and so any contact, that person becomes a partner, and you could actually create a whole tree out of that, theoretically. But, so.
Well, I see John Powell, at least, in, and I think he's taking note, and we will make sure that the amendments are shared with the department as well as with the insurers, but I would love to see that happen. Okay? Any other discussions? With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3022 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2435.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2435A requires the Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Board to issue limited license to qualified physicians intending to work in certain rural settings.
Okay, Kathleen Haley, Courtney Dresser, and Gwen Dayton, please come forward.
Madam Chair, these would probably be the appropriate people. I do have a question on the A6 and why we put a $50,000 figure in there. So, and they will address that, so that's
all right.
Good.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Board. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2435A, which would create an expedited licensure process for physician applicants to the medical board. The board is fully committed to expediting the Oregon medical licensure process while upholding its mission of public protection. The board recognizes that there are times that it takes too long to get physicians licensed and out practicing in the community. We have taken a number of steps, particularly in the last couple of years, to speed up the process, and we will continue to seek time-saving measures. And this is a commitment both by the board and the staff. To assist qualified applicants, we worked with the Governor's Office, the Oregon Hospital Association, and the Oregon Medical Association to draft a proposal for a licensure by endorsement. The Rhode Island Board of Medical Licensure already has this and has implemented it in December of 2008. Idaho is going to begin a similar process this summer. Theirs is a bit different than what we're proposing here in that they are requiring that an individual applicant have a board certification and a number of more years under their belt of practice. The process that we proposed by our work would allow the board to include as primary source verification the medical school verification, postgraduate verification, and medical examination scores from the initial licensing state. These documents have been identified as by our staff as slowing down the process. We pulled 12 files on applicants and said what's taking the longest from our standpoint, and those were some of the areas that we are trying to address with this expedited process. We anticipate faster licensure with this endorsement process, and of the states that have engaged in this, it has been faster for them. That's what we're getting in reports from Rhode Island. They don't have any hard data yet, but that's their anecdotal information. We are also committed to reporting our progress to the legislature, and I've attached a couple of charts to the testimony which indicates how the board compares to some of our surrounding states in terms of timelines and also the licensure requirements, what we're asking for as compared with some other states. I appreciate the time to talk with you about this bill this morning, and we're happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
It's just that what Representative Bence gave us, and I'm not sure you were given that, he listed a number of things that the Oregon Medical Board never received verifications from. So I'd like you to take a look at that, because it indicates that you had never received whatever verification that was needed. So if you would follow up with Representative Bence to make see that this, it appears it's a problem at Holy Rosary Medical Center in Ontario, Oregon.
Madam Chair, we will do that. We will follow up. We'll get the names of these applicants and follow up and get back to him on that. I also want to point out that we do have a technology project that was funded in 2007 that's going to come live for us this summer, which will have online licensure and also online renewal of licensure. So there will be less paperwork involved and more electronics.
Excellent. Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm the Executive VP and General Counsel for the Hospital Association. What I'd like to do with my brief testimony is update you on where we are on this bill. First, we very much have appreciated the opportunity to work as part of this work group with the Medical Board and the OMA, as well as the Governor's Office, and the participation of Representatives Bence and Roblin in really pushing this issue forward. We have the A6 in front of you, which implement the process that Kathleen just mentioned, this endorsement process. We are also anticipating A7s that implement a suggestion of Senator Bates to include recent retirees in this endorsement process. So those who have been relatively recently retired from the practice of medicine but now want to typically volunteer their services in their communities can take advantage of this expedited process. We also, in those amendments, noticed that the workgroup decided that $50,000 number was probably inappropriate to have in statute. It seems a little artificially low, and even if it's okay now, it's not going to be okay in a few years. So we put in significant malpractice award and anticipate letting the board make a judgment on what that number ought to be.
That's better.
Thank you, Senator Kurz. We felt that that was an appropriate change to make as well. I spoke with the legislative counsel yesterday, and she anticipated those amendments, the A7s, would be ready this morning, but they are not, and we hope that they will be soon for you to consider. And we also, frankly, even if you pass the, and we hope you will, 2435 with the A7 amendment, this is a work in progress. We hope to continue to work with the board and others as they implement the endorsement process to see how it's working. Is it making a difference? Are we expediting the licensing of qualified, safe physicians? If we still have are encountering barriers to that, we look forward to continuing to work with all the parties on this to overcome those barriers. So we appreciate the opportunity.
Excellent.
Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. I just want to thank the work group and also thank Representative Roblin and Representative Bence for bringing this issue forward. This provided an opportunity to have a much larger discussion and talking more about not just about rural practitioners but urban and rural and getting our physicians in the state working and licensed and as fast as possible, but still providing a mechanism to verify that they're qualified to work in this state. So I think that's where we ended up with the A7s.
All right.
Madam Chair, first I appreciate you bringing this forward. I especially appreciate the Medical Board supporting this. This is a huge leap forward. We've been dealing with this issue for 10 years, trying to get the paperwork more streamlined, trying to be more effective in doing electronic records. This is a leap forward, a quantum leap forward, and I would strongly recommend that we move this bill forward when we get the A7s. Not only from the point of view of the $50,000 figure going to the word significant, but I have a question about the bill too, but first I want to thank all three of you for being supportive on this, and I will be checking with the good representatives on the other side of the building to make sure that they're okay with this too. I think this will answer their questions about rural as well as physicians across the state. I do have one question, though, if I could, and I'm going to address this to Ms. Haley, I think. there's a phrase in the on line 10 of the dash sixes that says has been in continuous practice of the physician specialty for the last year. What is your definition of the word continuous? Quite often we'll see a physician get ready to make a move to a new area. They'll take 2 or 3 months off, get their affairs in order, and make a change. We're not talking about a year here. We're talking about a month or 2 or 3. Continuous almost leads me to think you mean more than that. It would seem appropriate to me to actually drop the word continuous out if you think that'd be appropriate, or I'd leave it in. But I'd like some idea what the definition of continuous means in this particular setting.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we were modeling some of this language from the other states that have adopted it, Rhode Island and Idaho, who are looking actually for longer periods of time. I totally agree with you that someone moving, making those kinds of changes, that can take a couple of months, maybe even longer. I have no problem with removing the word continuous.
Thank you. I would like to include that in the dash sevens. And the reason I'm thinking of this, not only from the point of view of making a change, but these physicians have to get endorsements from insurance companies and from hospitals. And while the board may now be leading the charge in this and getting the job done, the others will be still dragging their feet. Mm-hmm. But if they get their license first, it really speeds up the rest of the processes, because that's the first thing they ask for. Are you licensed in the state? And then you can use that for your hospital and your insurers. So really appreciate this. Thank you very much.
Great. Any other discussion? All right. Could we carry this over just in case we get the amendments back? So we'll carry it over to Thursday.
Madam Chair, if we're going to drop continuous, it will need to be, if the sevens are drafted, we need an eight. So,
We'll still carry it over. And if they're not ready, we'll just carry it over.
I'd like to get this all in the sevens and make it clean.
Yeah.
Gwen, can you help me with that?
Yes, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Bates, I will go directly to LC with my note in my hand and see if we can get continuous taken out of the A7s.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
All righty. There's no one else signed up for this bill, and no further discussion. Thank you very much, panel, and we will close the public hearing on 2435.
Announce you're carrying it over to all.
And yes, and we are carrying this over
to the 19th.
With I closed it 2435, and I will open a public hearing on 2058.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2058A standardizes health profession regulatory boards. There are some amendments in your packet. Or one.
All right. So, have we heard this bill? We haven't heard this bill yet.
Yes, we have. We're on the 30th.
Yes, we heard this bill on the 30th. Is that correct?
It was the 30th.
Okay.
A couple of weeks ago.
All right, and I'd like to call Holly Mercer, Patrick Bratz, and Stephen Kafori.
Stephen is at another hearing.
Okay. We're not moving the bill yet today because we still need the Oregon Medical Board. The Board of Nursing is making an attempt to change the language, which is the exact same language that is in under the Oregon Medical Board. So we'll bring that to your attention once Holly gets up here. Go for it.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Holly Mercer. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Nursing. I have submitted written testimony suggesting our changes for this bill. We found language
it hasn't been submitted, correct, the amendment yet?
That's correct. We included it in our written testimony. There are actually technical changes, but I think significant in that we want to make sure that when the governor appoints a public member, it isn't any more restrictive than any other board. And our current language in the bill states that a public member cannot have a family member or anyone related that is associated with anyone in any health care profession. We think that's too broad. We think it should be limited to just those licensees that are licensed through the Board of Nursing. So that's what we are suggesting. We also found when this change was made, and the effort on 2058 is actually to standardize boards, and for some reason the language concerning the appointment of all members for the governor to take into account geographic and ethnic diversity was left out of the Board of Nursing language, so we think that should be included. So that concludes what we think should be changed for the Board of Nursing piece of this legislation. I am happy to answer any questions.
Let's see. It's on page 8 of the bill, and if you would just point out the exact language.
It is on section 9. It's down on line 32 through 34.
Yes.
Is the section.
And they had left out...
And the other piece is on 35 through 37, and you'll see that in the italics were a mention of considered geographic balance in making the appointments, meaning they'd taken that out. We believe it should be inserted back in. So it's very, lines 32 through 37 are kind of the focus of our changes.
Okay. Excellent. Any questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
They've also dropped the no member shall be eligible for appointment for more than two consecutive terms. Did you want that removed?
I think that was changed throughout the bill,
yes,
sir.
Yes. So that people could be reappointed.
Mm-hmm. Interested.
Yes. Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, it was an interesting discussion whether or not to kind of build in turnover into the boards or not. And I know for some of the boards, they felt that this is a huge commitment for our volunteer boards. And when we found a board member who was working well and wanted to stay on, I believe the thinking was that maybe they should be able to. We currently have a limitation of two terms on our board.
Okay, follow up on this. Have you had problems filling slots?
To my knowledge, we have not had problems filling slots. We have a public member come up for reappointment this year. We also will have a turnover on a public member. I think the public members are going to be challenging. Our board reviews on a monthly basis. When we meet in person, they review over 1,000 pages of discipline. And I just think they have been committed. I'm surprised people actually stay on for two terms. I think that going forward, as we continue to grow, I think that it will be very challenging to get members for these boards.
Okay. Madam Chair, just from my experience on having served on a board or two in my time, that having a turnover on a regular basis, bringing fresh ideas and new blood into the board is a very positive thing, because boards could have a tendency to get stale if it's the same folks for a long period of time. But
I do have a question again. So on section 9.2c, where the public members serving on the board or their immediate family members may not be employed as a health professional or in any health-related industry. And we felt that was too broad, and I want to know exactly how that language you're proposing to change, because I'm not quite sure I understand.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, what we're proposing is that they may not be licensed by the Board of Nursing. Some boards would go through their particular licensees. For example, they would mention certified nurse assistants, licensed practical nurses, registered nurses. Then we have a combination of advanced practice nurses. Rather than that, we just said that they cannot be related to anyone that the Board of Nursing has jurisdiction over, which is, the point.
That's the point.
That's the point.
Exactly.
Yes.
Because that's how it is consistent throughout the rest of the boards. And this is what I want to bring to the board, the OMA, Oregon Medical Board, is the same language is in your section, and if you would be interested in standardizing that as the Board of Nursing is. And since we're on this topic, Catherine, do you want to just make a brief comment? I know you'll have to go back and
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Board. We agree with that change. It is too broad to say, particularly the line, or in any health-related industry.
That's the key.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, so if maybe you two could standardize what you're submitting to LC, it would be nice to have it all in one amendment.
Be happy.
That would address both of the issues. All right?
Be happy to.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Tafori. I'm here today representing the acupuncture in the Oregon Association of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. I have just a technical change that I'd like to ask if the the amendments in front of you, A7. The acupuncture profession is licensed by the Oregon Medical Board. And in the Oregon Medical Board, there is an acupuncture advisory committee. The members of that advisory committee are appointed by the board, but the nominations come from the professional association. During this last year, there were two professional associations of acupuncturists merged and have a new name, and therefore the name needs to be changed. So we simply changed the words Oregon Acupuncture Association to Oregon Association of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine.
And what I would like you to do is to confer with the Oregon Medical Board, and if there's controversy, it may not get put in, but I don't have a problem with the amendment being drafted.
Madam Chair, I can't imagine if there's any...
Oh, the amendment is here?
Yeah, you've got it in front of you.
It's just the name change.
It just changes the name.
It changes the name.
Okay. And would you make sure that Ms. Bradley has a copy of that? Do you have a copy of that, Ms. Bradley, the A7s? Yes. Okay. All right. And then you will let us know, because we aren't moving the bill today, and make sure there's consensus all around. Thank you.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Bratz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry. I'm here to speak on House Bill 2058A. This is a bill that came from Representative Greenlich, and actually he presented these ideas to a number of health boards as well as the associations, and we reviewed most of the information, and there was a lot of consensus on this. This is a very good bill. There's only one item in the bill that the Board of Dentistry has some concern over, and it has to do with changing the number of years in a term. Right now, each board has its own terms. For example, the medical board is a 3-year term, the dentistry board is a 4-year term. Consistency is good in many areas, and the consistency about the governor appointing all of these people, serving at the pleasure of the governor, having sent a confirmation, that all makes sense. But each one of these boards works differently in how they do their mission. Specifically, the Board of Dentistry, we spend a great deal of time, as Ms. Mercer has mentioned to you, on the disciplinary arena. 1,000 pages of documentation. Ours, we meet 6 times a year. We probably have 800 pages of documentation that we're reviewing. To reduce the number of years in a term, I think is inconsistent with good public policy, and as Senator Cruz said, sometimes you want to have turnover, but at the same time you want to have experience. Most of our board members will tell us that it takes about a year. Now, when I say a year, I don't mean 365 days. I mean 6 meetings. And by eliminating 1 year off of the term, now you have eliminated 6 meetings. You've eliminated that amount of experience. You have someone up to speed. Now they basically serve for 2 years if they decide that they don't want to be reappointed. We've not had any problems with the governor finding people to serve on the board, both public and professional members. In my tenure with the board, and as I go back and look in history, most board members only serve 2 terms. They could be, our current statute was not changed, they could have been reappointed for multiple terms. They just choose not to do so, or governors choose not to make that appointment. So we're we're just asking the committee to look at this, to go and possibly introduce an amendment that would simply leave the term, the years and the terms alone as they are right now in current law. That was the only area that all the health boards and all the associations could not reach consensus. Some that wanted three didn't want to go to four. Some that wanted four didn't want to go to three. And so I know Representative Greenlick just decided, well, we're going to be consistent among everything, so we'll just pick a number. We're just encouraging the committee to look at the fact that just leave the term years alone. The rest of the bill is very good. Those changes are very supported by the board, as well as almost all of the health boards that were working on this project. So I'm happy to answer any questions if you have some.
Any discussion on this? It's nice to have consistency. Let's give it some thought.
That's fine. We appreciate that.
All right. Any other discussion on this matter? All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on 2058, and I'll open a public hearing on 2059.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2059A requires health professional licensee to report prohibitive or unprofessional conduct of another licensee to the regulatory board responsible for the licensee.
All right. Now, this is one of Representative Greenlick's bills, and it was basically to make sure that every licensee, it would be unprofessional conduct if they would not report any problems with another licensee. He's not here, but let us call, I'm not sure, is Tom here, Powers? Yeah. Do you want to just address the whole bill just to give us a good overview of it, and then we'll get into all these other people that want to speak to it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tom Powers, work for Representative Greenlick over in the House. I think that Bruce Bishop and Brian Parrott, who have signed up from Northwest Permanente and the Oregon Medical Association, were both very involved in the work group, which was chaired by Representative Garrett and Representative Kennemer, and can probably do a great deal better at explaining the provisions of the bill. I was asked to speak to the A8 amendments to the bill.
Then Bruce Bishop and Brian Parrott, please come forward.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, Senior Counsel for Northwest Permanente, the medical group associated with Kaiser Permanente. We were privileged to participate on the work group that was chaired by Representative Garrett and Representative Kennemer, and the A-engrossed bill of House Bill 2059 is a substantially improved product over the original bill, which we thought was largely unworkable as originally introduced. What the bill does now is specify what is mandatory reporting by all health professional licensees of other health professional licensees. This is not just nurses reporting nurses or physicians reporting physicians. It will create an obligation that all health professional licensees report other misconduct that they observe in two specific areas. One is for prohibited conduct, which is conduct involving patient harm or the risk of patient harm, and the other is in reporting criminal conduct. And the bill specifies what are reportable acts. This bill, like others that you've considered, including the preceding bill, is motivated by the desire to standardize practices across all the health professional boards. The bill will modify some practices because some boards have a higher level of reporting requirements now than the bill specifies. Other boards have lower, so that's the process of balancing out here. But the goal of the bill is to standardize those reporting practices across all health professional types.
Madam Chair,
with the bill,
Senator Cruz,
if I could just to clarify, Bruce, we are not talking about substance abuse programs at all here, are we? Or are we?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we are not.
Okay,
we may be talking about that in some other bills, but
okay, because that's a separate and distinct.
In this bill, we're talking about specific harm to patients or criminal conduct.
Okay.
Okay.
When the amendments were presented to the House committee, there was, in our opinion, a drafting issue that surfaced. The House committee decided to move the bill along, notwithstanding that issue, to allow the Senate to consider that issue. That issue is addressed in the A6 amendments that we presented to you. What that does, we're concerned that the way the bill was drafted, prohibited conduct could be beyond what is specified in the statute. Prohibited conduct is a new defined term in the statute that it would be a standard reporting requirement for all licensees. The way the bill was drafted, it gave some discretion to licensing boards to develop other definitions of prohibited conduct, which would run against the purpose of the bill's standardization. So the A6 amendment makes clear that boards cannot develop their own definitions of prohibited conduct that goes beyond the statutory definition. We think that will make the bill even better and actually accomplish the bill's original purpose, and would urge the committee's adoption of the A6 amendment to House Bill 2059.
Yeah, have you shared this with the boards? Catherine, have you seen the A6 amendment? No. Okay. So it'll be important for you to follow up on that. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Brian Parrott, and I am outside counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. We, too, were pleased to participate in the work group. We agree that it has come a long way from where we started. One of our main concerns is that we did not feel it was appropriate for members of one profession to evaluate the standard of care of another profession. That is, a dentist should not be able to tell a doctor whether they are practicing within their scope of practice standard of care. We did a lot of work to try to clarify that what we are talking about here is unethical behavior and that behavior that constitutes harm to a patient or criminal conduct. I think we came a long way in doing that. I'm here because I share the concern raised by Mr. Bishop that I believe that specifically it is Section 1, Paragraph 9. I believe that does too much to undo the standardization that we tried so hard to achieve by allowing the individual boards to regulate prohibited conduct, and there's some...
Could you cite exactly where in the bill, page 2?
Page 2, line 41 and 42.
Okay.
There is some question, the last two words in line 42, whether provided by law includes rules or if it's only statutes. I did some research on it, and quite honestly, I could not find the answer to that. If this, in fact, does include rules, then we have allowed every existing rule to continue in force, and therefore we have done nothing to standardize it because we have just created additional instead of we've added to what exists currently and let what exists currently continue. So we would like to propose that actually be changed to by statute. And we believe that would indicate we're talking about statutory requirements, child abuse reporting. Those were the areas that we intended to pull in under this language. And that amendment has not been written yet. We would like to submit it.
All righty. I would like you to submit that amendment, and then we will discuss it as a committee. All right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Now we have Dash 8 amendments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. The Dash A8 amendments would incorporate whatever amendments that Mr. Parrott and Mr. Bishop would bring to you because they refer back to Section 1, but do not change Section 1 of the bill. Simply, the Dash A8 amendments would add the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board and the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board to the boards that would be affected by this act. They were not included in the original draft, and each of those.
The mortuary board, and what was the other one?
The Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examiner Board.
Oh, yes, that's right.
They both asked to be included in the provisions in this bill. And this amendment would do that.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Where did dash 7 come from?
Yeah, we have a dash 7, but we know Mr. Barrows will... Someone will be talking about.
All right.
Okay. So let's have Jennifer Schnickler and Jackson Williams. Now, you're going to be addressing the dash 7.
Yes. Okay.
Good morning, Senator, or Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Schmickler. I'm an associate with Dave Barrows and Associates in Portland, Oregon. We represent the National Certification Board for Therapeutic Massage and Bodywork here in Oregon. We've been communicating with the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy and Claudia Black from the Governor's Office in an effort to try and reinstate the national certification exam, which was removed by the board without the required OAR notice to interested parties in November of 2007. We bring this amendment before you today to allow the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy to once again accept the national certification exam and also accept a Spanish version, as it is currently required that the exam be taken in English, whereas our exam is also offered in Spanish. We recently met with Chair Monica Anderson and also Senator Morissette. We were able to squeeze in.
Have a relating clause.
To discuss,
as well as Representative Greenlake. I spoke with him about it.
Yes, we have also met with Chair Greenlake. On the House side, to discuss the background and purpose of this amendment. We scheduled appointments also with the rest of the committee in order to discuss this, but due to timing, the hearing was scheduled before our appointments. We were able to get in. So we are going to keep those appointments should the committee have any questions further about this amendment. We ask that you adopt this Dash 7 amendment today in order to request a fiscal on time before the bill is heard again. And with me today is Jackson Williams. He's the legislative director for the National Certification Board for Therapeutic Massage and Bodywork. And he will go into detail on the substance of the amendment, and I will remain here if you have any questions.
Thank you.
But not too much detail, I promise, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good morning. We are a certification board.
And introduce yourself for the record.
Jackson Williams. We are a certification board for massage therapists. We have approximately 2,200 certificates here in Oregon. We're not a governmental entity, but under a longstanding tradition in the allied health fields, our exams have been relied upon by states for licensing purposes. Licensure through certification is the path for most allied health professions to become licensed in Oregon, including nurse anesthetist, midwife, dental assistant, physician assistant. I could go on, but I won't. Several years ago, an alliance was formed between state massage regulators across the country and ABMP, a for-profit insurer that sells liability policies to massage therapists. The leading regulator in this effort was Patty Glenn, who's the executive director of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy. As the head of a semi-independent health board, Ms. Glenn, like insurers, has an economic incentive to increase the number of licensees so that they can, regulate more people, collect more fees, sell more liability insurance policies. The way they could accomplish this goal is by creating a new examination that is easier to pass than ours. So they convened a Federation of State Massage Therapy Boards headed by Ms. Glenn to create this new exam. Even before the new Federation exam was ready in 2007, the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy passed a resolution to accept it in the state of Oregon without any sort of review process. Then, a few months later, the OBMT passed another resolution to discontinue acceptance of our national certification exam. These resolutions were passed without giving any notice to the public or interested parties. They were not on meeting agendas. I don't think there was basic due process in administrative rulemaking. It appears that the Oregon Board may have been acting in the interests of the Federation to which it belongs rather than in the interests of the public or profession in Oregon. Oregon is one of only two states that solely accept this new federation exam. This makes it more difficult for businesses in Oregon, such as chiropractors or spas, to hire highly skilled massage therapists from out of state. It also makes it more difficult for Oregon massage school graduates to move out of state to practice. At a time of 12.1% unemployment, mobility and portability of credentials are important, and workers need to keep their options open. Of the dozen U.S. states with the lowest unemployment rates that perhaps someone might want to migrate to, only three of those accept this new exam, meaning that new graduates who relocate must sit for our exam anyways. We have attempted to exhaust our remedies on the administrative side before seeking legislation or litigation. Our chair and executive director are going to be in Salem Friday to present themselves to the Oregon Board, answer any and all questions that the Board may have regarding our organization and our exams. We are submitting to a process that the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy never required of a competing exam. Unfortunately, we do not anticipate that we will get our exam restored by that board, and that is why we are here with this amendment. This amendment would leave the choice of which exam to take to the graduate and be licensed through either exam.
I just have one comment on this. I know when I took my, it's nice to have one licensing exam nationwide. That's why I'm so glad that when I got my nursing degree in the state of Virginia, they had just changed the rules and there was reciprocity, so I was able to practice in Oregon without retaking an Oregon licensing exam. With massage therapy, I feel strongly that this is a very decent request, and that if you are licensed in massage therapy by a national certification exam, there should be reciprocity here in the state of Oregon with that exam, and that's what the amendment would propose, because evidently, and I'm just regurgitating, I think, what you said, the Board of Massage Therapy had changed that and disallowed anyone to be a massage therapist. You would have to take the the Federation of Massage Therapy exam instead. Mm-hmm. So that's what it is. I'm not going to move the bill at this point in time, but that is what I want the committee to consider. We've already talked to Representative Greenleck. And does Claudia Black want to say anything?
No.
All right. Any questions at this point in time? And that is the dash sevens.
That's correct,
Madam Chair.
Okay. And we will need to make sure that the Board of Massage Therapy sees this amendment because I'm sure they will want to rebut it.
Okay.
All right.
Yes.
Do we have a chance to actually discuss the bill? I understand this is a relating clause
yes.
issue.
Yes, yes.
No problem.
Okay.
Do we have a chance to discuss the bill itself?
All right. We can do that.
How much time do you have left in your...
Well, I want to have... I know people have been waiting for House Bill 2194. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to move the bill. I would prefer that we would then...
Okay.
No, we're not going to adopt any amendments at this point in time.
I think they need to adopt the amendment so they can get the physical on it to bring it back to us is the issue.
Oh. You're absolutely right.
So, do we have a quorum?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would... No, we're not in a work session. No, we're in public
hearing. I will close the public hearing on 2059 and open a work session on House Bill 2059.
Madam Chair, I would move that we move the dash 7 amendments into House Bill 2059A engrossed.
Senator Bates moves the dash 7 amendments into House Bill 2059. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Excused.
Chair Monica?
Aye. Amendment, dash 7 amendments adopted. And I think with that, I'm going, you wanted to make a comment. Is there something?
No, I'd like to wait till the full committee's here and we can have a further discussion. There's some issues here I just don't quite understand, and I'm not sure the bill's actually getting to the issue we're trying to get to, so I just don't want to have that discussion, is all.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Given the controversy we've had with the current status of the massage therapist, I have mixed feelings. We're going to do an overhaul, or they're going to do a kind of a coming together and look at their scope of practice. I don't mind moving this. I'd like to hear from the board. Cindy Roberts is in the room. We don't have to hear now, but in all fairness, we have to have a broader discussion of this bill and the consequences of it and the fact that they are going to work to narrow the scope, and I want to know how that fits in with the other board or the other exam that they're talking about.
All right.
So I look forward to that discussion.
And that'll give you more time, Massage Therapy Board, to look at what the amendment is and the impact.
Just for clarification, I'm not with the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy. I'm with the American Massage Therapy Association.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. No.
Whatever.
Thank you.
That's true. All right. With that, I will close a public hearing on 2059 and quickly open a work session on 2094. And we are in work session, and I'm not going to move this bill because we have so many amendments. And I want to only take just a few minutes for those who have amendments to briefly let us know what they are, and then we're going to have an informational hearing from the Alzheimer's Association. So, Rocky, are you the one that's going to speak, or no? No. Okay, who's going to speak? Oh, there's no one to speak on 2194 except for Doug Barber and John Powell. One amendment. Okay, come on up and just briefly, and then because we'll have more discussion on this, but at least I want to get a handle on what you're talking about.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Powell representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I have the dash A3 amendment, which simply deletes one sentence on page 4 of the bill, part of line 1 and part of line 2, and that sentence reads, reinsurers may be subject to the assessment as required by the board. That sentence is redundant since the definition of insurer on page 1, it says insurer means, and B, any reinsurer reinsuring medical insurance in the state. So it's simply a redundancy that we would advocate eliminating from the bill.
And I would not know what the ramifications of this would be, and we would need... Let's see, on page 4, line 1, after the period, delete the rest of the line.
Madam Chair, again, there would be no change in the status of reinsurers being subject to the assessment. Again, because insurers are subject to the assessment, and on page 1, the definition of an insurer includes reinsurer. So the addition of that sentence, and no one knows why it was put in there. I talked to Mr. King about it, and they were unaware of to why, and so they were okay with it.
And Rocky's nodding in the back that he's okay. Okay, thank you very much.
There's no opposition to it.
All right.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters and speaking in support of the Dash 4, A4 amendments. The Dash 4s are the same as House Bill 2192, which was another bill introduced by the OMIP Board and the Governor's Office on the House side. Currently, the funding for the high-risk pool, for the OMIP pool, comes from those who purchase commercial insurance. These are individuals, small groups, and some large groups. They pay a surcharge every month to help fund that high-risk pool. But there is a growing group of more than 600,000 insured Oregonians who do not contribute to the high-risk pool. And these are people who purchase their insurance through self-insured plans or union trusts. And the dashboards would address this problem. The OMIP board realized that if they expand the pool and everyone contributes, they can lower the rate, and as a result, the pool will be more healthy. There have been a number of arguments put forward about why these two groups should not contribute to the pool. When we have some more time, I would gladly go through very quickly those arguments about why I don't think they hold water. The bottom line, I believe, is that everyone benefits from the high-risk pool, and everyone should contribute to the high-risk pool, and that's what this bill does.
Thank you. I think we've had this discussion in Ways and Means, I believe, where the self-insureds, right now, the only people that are contributing to the OMIP pool it's getting smaller and smaller, and it's the small group and the individual market at this point in time.
And those large groups that still buy commercial insurance. But what we're seeing, the trend is more and more large groups are going self-insured.
Okay. We know this issue, and thank you for bringing the amendment forward, and we don't have time to discuss it at this point in time since I want to get to the Alzheimer's group. All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2194 and open an informational hearing on the Alzheimer's State Plan.
Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. My name is Walt Dawson. I'm from Polk County here in Oregon, although I've been away at graduate school the last couple of years. Like other people you will hear from today, I personally know the great tragedy that is Alzheimer's disease. It is a tragedy for both patients and families alike. I was only 8 years old when my father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. He suffered with Alzheimer's for almost 7 years before he passed away from the disease. Unfortunately, my mother and I were unable to care for my father in our own home and were forced to place him in a care center, first here in Salem and then out in Dallas, Oregon. The costs associated with my father's care were financially devastating for my family. And within a little over a year, our savings were completely wiped out. These were funds that had been saved specifically so that one day I could attend college. Fortunately for my father and the many other people who currently require long-term care in the state, the Medicaid program covered the cost of his care once we could no longer pay out of pocket. While our particular experience may have been exceptional in the fact that I was so young and my father was older than most parents, the same situation faces thousands of Oregonians and their families who are diagnosed with this terrible disease. This situation will only get worse in the coming years as the population continues to age here in Oregon. That is why it is imperative for Oregon to adopt a state plan to address Alzheimer's disease head-on, as many other states have done in recent months. Since my father's illness, I have gone on to devote much of my professional life to the study of health policy, with a particular emphasis on long-term care policy reform. I'm currently working on my doctorate at Oxford University in Great Britain, where I've had the opportunity to look at the way other countries, the way the policymakers in other countries handle an aging population, rise in rates of Alzheimer's disease, and make long-term care policy. And while every other country does things a little differently, one of the most important lessons that I've learned that a coordinated effort to tackle a crisis as large as the one we face with Alzheimer's disease is necessary. And with the coordinated effort as proposed here today, we, as a state, will be much better placed to handle the demands placed on the state's long-term care system. So on behalf of Alzheimer's patients, caregivers, and their families, I urge you to support a state plan for Alzheimer's disease and make Alzheimer's a top priority. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for sharing your story. It's a growing. It's almost like an epidemic, and it's going to only mushroom. Thank you.
Thank you all. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kate Dyer Seeley. I'm the Public Policy and Communications Coordinator for the Oregon Alzheimer's Association. Thanks so much for your time this morning. In your packets, I have outlined some state plans. There's light reading if your staff wants to look at actual state plans, but really what I included for the most part are pieces of actual legislation that came from those plans. 20 years ago, one of the leading researchers up at OHSU was told that in his lifetime, he would probably never see a case of Alzheimer's because it was so rare. Today in the state of Oregon, we have 76,000 people dealing with the disease, which translates into 122,000 caregivers due to the level of care required. And as you stated, Senator Monica Anderson, there will be an epidemic. We anticipate a 93% increase in the incident rate here in the state of Oregon. We don't have the luxury of waiting another 20 years to deal with this crisis. From Kentucky to California, states have been assembling task forces and passing legislation. Some examples in your packet include Iowa, where you'll see specific legislation, as well as Missouri, where you'll see kind of a fiscal note in what they did there. So that's my short little statement, and I'd like to open it up to questions.
So, what department in the other states does the Alzheimer's state plan, is it in? Is it in their Department of Human Services? Or
it's really varied from state to state. Each state has kind of taken, their own look at that. And we're open to suggestions, of course, but there's a list. Did you want to jump in, Karen?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Garst. I'm the newest board member of the Alzheimer's Association. I, too, have a story. My aunt had Alzheimer's for 15 years, and I went back to South Dakota every 2 or 3 years to see her, and you could just see the devastation, how it impacted the whole family. What we'd like to do here today is just simply request to be on your interim committee to come in and discuss how we would put a task force together, who are the people who would need to be involved. The Alzheimer's Association is willing to staff this. I served and as staff and participated in a number of these statewide task forces, and as a board member am willing to help on this effort. We do believe that it's time. I notice my own home state of North Dakota is ahead of us, which is causes a little bit of chagrin. We want to have the opportunity in the interim to talk to you about putting a task force together involving the appropriate agencies. We will provide most of the staff to be able to develop a plan that could result in possible legislation during the next legislative session. So this is really just introductory to get on your interim committee list of issues. There's no bill associated with it.
So right now the Alzheimer's Association is a nonprofit.
We are a nonprofit.
And how many members? Or do you have a board, or what is the makeup of the Alzheimer's Association?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are a nonprofit here in Oregon. We serve the entire state, so we have chapter offices in Portland, Medford, Bend, and Eugene, with about a 15-person staff, and then a board of directors, which is a volunteer board of directors. We also are associated with a national office who's willing to help, and who you'll see, a lot of the examples of what other states are doing from. So we can pull their resources as well.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Well, I know the gentleman who is involved in the association in Eugene, but just give me a quick overview of what your priorities are in terms of this identification, prevention, and so on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Morissette and members of the committee. I think our big goal, and if you look into your last page, page 6, sort of the general global things that we'd like to address. I think one issue that we see as we know this tidal wave of people that are coming is that there is no coordination of care. And so you're going to see a lot of individual bills coming through that address specific pieces, but no one's looking at it from a global perspective. So we'd like to look at, daycare, health care, long-term care for the state, early detection, public safety issues, driving, wandering, transportation issues, financing, Medicare, Medicaid, what that system will look like, and then just, the breadth of issues that caregivers are impacted by. A lot of times caregivers have to leave the workforce to care for their loved ones, so how we coordinate care for them as well.
I know that Senator Morissette had an interim committee on senior issues, and actually your committee deals primarily with it. The reason we brought you here, because I had a bill, a dementia bill.
Yes.
And so there was a whole lot of information that we didn't know and that you were able to actually provide as with that. But I think that between the two of us, we will figure out which committee, because we're not sure what interim committees there will be. But I think this is an excellent idea, because it is an issue that is overwhelming families right now, and it's only going to grow.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would just add, if you have an opportunity, probably after the session, there's an excellent HBO series that's airing. We had a little event last night to see the first hour of that series. I think it's a four-part series, and Maria Shriver has been involved in promoting it. And last night, they just did a vignette from different stages of Alzheimer's and had actual patients and their families, and it was a really good overview of the disease. And maybe during the interim, you have a chance to see that series. I think you can download it from the Internet.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, I'm so glad. Yes, Senator Bates?
Just a quick comment. It seems to me what you're driving for here is a state task force.
Mm-hmm.
And so this can be looked at carefully. And also, you've kind of suggested something I think is quite unusual, but which we might be seeing more and more of as we go through the next couple of years with state funds, general funds being so restricted. It appears you might be suggesting this be funded by other funds, and possibly you can get some federal matching monies for these. So you could get a state task force going with the auspice of the state to help you, but not in position as we are now to fund this. And so it might be a way to start not only a good task force, but looking a little different way to set task force up when we just haven't got the revenue we need right now. So I think that's what I'm getting from this material. I'm looking at it. And correct me if I'm wrong. I'm getting some head nods here, so maybe I've got the right idea.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
There are two health long-term care providers sitting in the back of the room that would be involved in this discussion, I'm sure.
Yes, and Senator Bates and members of the committee, absolutely. I think that we feel like this is not something that can wait. And we've had task forces in the state on things like diabetes and asthma and this.
Obesity.
Yeah, exactly. not that there's anything. We like looking at those things, too. But this is going to impact every part of our state. And we're a very gray state right now as it stands. And as baby boomers age, we're just going to be blown away. So, yes, we're willing to look at whatever we need to do to get the discussion moving on this one.
So I want to make sure our administrator has your names, because this is definitely something that either Senator Morissette or I, depending on who's assigned senior issues in the interim, will definitely be following up with and see what we can develop for, who knows, February, at least for sure the next session. Full session. All right.
Thank you so much.
Any other questions?
Thank you
so much for coming, and thanks for staying so long. But maybe you enjoyed hearing all these bills. All right. With that, we're adjourned.